Hello, my name's Tom Walker. Welcome to the Christmas, yes, the Christmas edition of That'll Be the Day. In this podcast, I'm talking to a visually impaired polymath who's a writer, director, actor, and activist. But before we hear from Mandy Redvers Rowe, if you like the music at the start of this podcast, it's a track called That'll Be the Day by the Liverpool band The Vow. And as always, I'll be playing a track by the band at the end of this podcast. Stay tuned in to find out which one I've chosen. It's also worth listening to the podcast because not only will you hear Mandy, but also you will hear some wonderful Christmas music by the excellent Andrea Begley. Now, most of us can cope with two or three things going on in our lives, but Mandy's got a million things going on. And tonight, we're actually standing in front of the stage at Harrison Hall in Wallasey because Mandy's directing the pantomime Jack and the Beanstalk. Mandy, how'd you do it?
Oh, wow. I don't always know, Tom. But, yeah, I just love everything to do with theatre and... Because we all have to make a living, you end up diversifying. This, you know, it's not possible in our business, I think, to just do one thing and to succeed in one way. So I have a natural interest in all of those things. Certainly I started as an actor, but directing was always part of my brief, and also writing was always something I did. So I think I've just taken the work where it's come, and people have asked me to do things, and because I'm a freelancer, I've not always been a freelancer, I've been a freelancer to start with, and then I got proper jobs, and then now I'm a freelancer again, you never say no.
Before we talk about work at any great length, let's just talk first of all about Christmas. You love Christmas, don't you?
I do. I love Christmas, and I love pantomimes, and that's where we are now.
Is this your favourite time of the year?
Definitely one of them, yes. It's my highlight of the winter. I do love summer, and I love the winter leading up to Christmas. I find after Christmas, January, February, they're quite hard months because there's nothing to look forward to in the same way, and I do love everything to do with Christmas. I love the music, I love the excitement, I love the smell of the air, I love all of that, yeah, the food. Everything, yeah, the preparation, the family time, I like it all.
We're of a similar age, so let's go back, I don't know, 40-odd years when you were, what, in your teens? Because yeah. You were fully sighted, weren't you?
I was, yeah. I became registered blind at 16, and I suppose for a few years leading to that I'd been partially sighted. But I was always told I'd get my sight back, so I've got child uveitis, so... you know, without going too medical, which I don't normally do, actually. I had a lot of operations, and I was always told I would get sight back. But then, of course, some of the operations started not to be successful, and rather than get sight back, I started to lose sight. And so I got registered blind at 16 and went to Chorley Wood School at 17 and joined the sixth form there.
How did you cope as a teenager with losing your sight?
I think I'm one of those people that... obviously it felt devastating, but there's part of me that just carries on. I'm a bit like a clockwork, you know, toy. I just go forward and try and solve problems. And I think it was only about 8 years after I was registered blind that the real reality of that being my lifelong condition hit me. And I did have a dip then, definitely. I did have a dip. But at the time, I just... problem solved. That's what I do. I problem solved. I sort this out and I sort that out. And yes, I certainly had tearful times, but mainly I focused on how to solve the problem of visual impairment and how to find ways to, you know, become an independent visually impaired person, because I was very angry about the thought that people wanted to help me. I didn't like that at all. So the only way to solve that was to find ways to do things myself, which is what I did.
How did your family cope?
Yeah, you know, mixed. My mom was very strong. yeah, some of the other family, everyone tried to support me, but nobody knows how to support someone, do they, when they're losing their sight? We don't know ourselves how to cope, so why we expect everyone else to know? We don't. It's all a bit messy, isn't it, when you look back? But yeah, everyone came round in the end.
You've been to mainstream school and then fetched up, if I can put it that way, at Chorley Wood School for the Blind.
Yeah.
What was that like? That must have been very different, because Chorley Wood, let's be honest, was a rather old-fashioned school.
It was very old-fashioned, yeah, yeah. Culturally, it was a real... It was like going back to the 1920s. I mean, I'd been a teenager at home, going to parties and discos. That's how old I am. Discos.
You went to discos, did you?
Yes, I loved a disco.
Did you?
Oh, I love a
boogie. My sister used to go.
Oh, yeah. No, I love that. My favourite place. And at Chorley Wood, you were not allowed out. The last bus left at 7.
That didn't stop you?
No, I
think you found your way into a couple of pubs, didn't you?
I did. We weren't supposed to go to pubs. But, yeah, me and my friend Jill went to pubs and then got caught. And it got told off, but yeah.
It must have been a huge contrast to what you've been used to there.
Yeah.
As you say, 1920s.
It was, but you know what was good about it? And I can only say that now I can look back as an older person. The really good thing was meeting lots of other visually impaired and blind people at my own age who are ordinary. Because I think until you do that, you have this awful thing that you think, I'm not like blind people, because you don't feel blind, you just happen not to be able to see. But until you meet other people in exactly the same position who are, as you would, you know, who are just ordinary people, ordinary young women wanting to have parties and have fun, who also happen not to be able to see, you suddenly realise, ah, I get it. None of us are the stereotypical blind person, because the stereotypical blind person doesn't exist.
Did it help with the adjustment to be with other visually impaired young women?
Yeah, really, really helped. Yeah, really helped.
I describe you as an activist. Mm. How did the activism start?
Yes, I'm never comfortable with the word activist.
Sorry.
No, but it's fine. But I did, I'm very much a political being. So in the disability sense, definitely. I believe in the social model of disability, and that completely changed my mind when I discovered the social model of disability. And, you know, I've certainly been on demonstrations, and all my work and all what I try to do is introduce the idea that disability, you know, is not what people think it is, and we're not passive receivers of help. We are individuals in our own right dealing with barriers that happen to exist in society, which have been put there mainly by other people, meaning whether they mean to or not. And the design of society has created a lot of those barriers too. And so what we need to do is remove those barriers, whether they're attitudinal or physical barriers that exist within society. So that's my aim, and that's the things I've always tried to do. And whether I do it through art, and I've always done it through art, really, to try and just introduce people to an alternative view of disability through theatre and through drama.
How did you go about changing people's minds on disability, particularly those people who wouldn't identify themselves as having a disability?
I'm not sure I have. You know, you just don't know, do you? And the older I get, it's really hard to change people's minds. I think what I'm aiming for is a cultural shift, so that culturally disabled people are accepted more. So that's incremental. That's more people having disabled people on TV, disabled people in shows, disabled presenters. Incrementally, people will start to see us as just part of the landscape, just part of the population, just people who happen to be there. We might have a wheelchair, we might not be able to see, we might be deaf or neurodivergent, but we're there. And that's what I think, that's the only way we'll change things.
Some people of a certain age, including me, will remember the Direct Action Network, the telethon demonstrations. To what extent were you involved in those?
I was there, yes. I had my Piss on Pity t-shirt, and I almost got arrested that day because I was part of a cabaret group called No Excuses with Mandy Colleran and Ali Briggs, and we were performing in front of the ITV studios, along with Barbara Lazicki and Johnny Crescendo and all the speakers. We were just one of the acts. Barbara and Johnny organised a cabaret with lots of disabled performers, and we were one of them. And then we set off on the march, which was legal, around the ITV studios. We went the wrong way because Mike Higgins, who's blind, led it and went the wrong direction. So we wanted a massive walk the wrong way around the studios. And then at the end, Mike said, you know, anyone who wants to finish there, that's the end of the legal demonstration. Please, thank you very much for your support. But we are now going to try and get into the studios. And we all just charged at the studios. And we were right at the back. My friend Mandy is a wheelchair user, said, she noticed that the cars, although all the doors were barred and there were security people in front of the doors, that cars are still getting in the underground car park. So we went into the underground car park, and we were followed by a few other disabled people, and we nearly got to the lift before we were stopped. And then about 20 policemen came in to walk us out. There's only about 6 or 7 of us. I had a friend who took her plug out of her electric wheelchair so they couldn't move her. A deaf person took out their hearing aids and sat on their hands and shut their eyes so they couldn't see what people were trying to say to us. It was really radical. And my friend Natalie Markham and I were the last two to be dragged out. And we decided not to be dragged, and we just walked out. I had my guide dog with me. My gosh, it was crazy, yeah.
Did that change attitudes at the time, do you think?
I think it certainly led with alongside people legally going to visit their MP and asking for change, asking for the legal acceptance of the Anti-Discrimination Act, the DDA. Those two things, us demonstrating plus people quite legally visiting their MPs, brought about the DDA in 1995 and the Anti-Discrimination Act.
And what is your impression as to how that changed things, and are things still improving?
I think it did change things for a while, and I think what happened is we all relaxed and thought we'd got what we wanted, and we stopped. We thought it was churlish to continue to protest. We'd got what we wanted. But actually, looking back, things started to slip a few years later. It started to get better, and then it slipped. The DDA got moved into the Equalities Act, and that's now got moved even further into the Human Rights Act. And once again, we're bottom of the pile, and it feels like we're going backwards. I don't know how you feel, Tom, but it feels to me like our fight for equality is slipped right back.
It seems to me as if things have gone into reverse.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how it feels, yeah.
What needs to happen now to, I don't know, re-energise the whole process?
I think it needs the next generation. They need to get together and start to fight again, take direct action, yeah.
Some of the actors are beginning to arrive for this evening's rehearsal, but I hope they'll bear with us while we're chatting away. Good evening. Evening, there you go. I want to talk to you about your acting and all the artwork you're doing. How did you get into all of that?
Well, I didn't realise, but I always wrote pantomimes at home. It never occurred to me I'd get involved in theatre. But when I lost my sight and I went to university, I took drama as a year. It's my minor subject. I thought it would give me some confidence, but I completely fell in love with it, and it became my major, and it became my life. And I thought, when I left uni, everything's going to be hard for me. You know, why not do what I want to do? So I started my career in theatre.
I'm going to ask you to do the impossible, which is to try and summarise your career in about 5 minutes.
Okay. Right. So I started as a freelancer, acting and directing, moved into my first paid role with the Liverpool Playhouse as youth theatre director. Then I became the artistic director of the Northwest Disability Arts Forum. Then I moved into lecturing. I lectured at LIPA in disability arts and community arts. And then I moved as a lecturer to Hope University, directed in applied theatre. All the time I tried to write as well. Then I moved to a company called Collective Encounters, where I was the creative producer, which became the head of participation. And that's a theatre for social change company where we developed theatre pieces with participant groups. All the time, through that, I've, you know, I've had children, and locally, where we are now, is my local, I suppose, community theatre company, and I've often directed here as a volunteer, and my children grew up being in the pantomimes here, so that's running alongside, and then I moved, my writing took off, and now I'm a freelance writer, and I do write for television. I've done some radio, and I still write for stage, and I'm an access consultant as well, because the writing isn't quite paying enough to completely be independent.
What are the challenges you faced as a totally blind person in what I call this crazy business of media, arts, yeah, drama?
Oh, gosh. There's loads.
Okay, so we'll start with you, Emily and Molly, coming on stage, pushing the... Imagine the dancers are there and push them off. Can we have quiet, please, in the auditorium? Thank you.
When you're ready. So as a director, so this is what you'll see me doing a bit of tonight. I stand in... this is a very traditional proscenium arch. We're doing Jack and the Beanstalk by Gillian McKeith, and it's a wonderful play where we've got four brownies who break it, basically come in late to the show and end up getting onto the stage and getting involved in the show. It's really good. We've got some great actors in the group, really fantastic, and a chorus. We've got a very traditional proscenium arch, so I'm standing here with you on the ground level, the audience level, but across the orchestra pit up there is a raked stage with a proper proscenium arch with curtains, and the action takes place there. And what I do is I stand in the middle. I've got, there's a little knob on this, there's like a banister in front of the orchestra.
Here it is.
Yeah, so that I don't fall into the orchestra. Well, nobody falls into the orchestra. And there's a little knob which shows I'm at the middle, and then I can check whether people are the right... I keep saying balance the stage, but I can tell if they're all over to one side or over to the left. But I also work with two choreographers, because when you're working with big numbers of people on stage, I do need the people with eyes to go, yeah, that stage picture works, that stage picture doesn't.
So you'd be using your hearing to a great extent here.
Hearing to great. But I also think people can't lie as actors with their voices so much. So when I'm working to get people into character, I can always tell when they're there and when they're not.
Don't you come back no more.
Well done. Brilliant. Brilliant. Wonderful. Just got to be careful to listen to the music and keep that energy high, everyone. Brilliant, brilliant, Reese.
But I do blocking. I work on a Thursday with just the actors to get the movement right. The choreographers work with the dancers and the chorus to get their movement right. Then we work together on a Tuesday night here to make it all work in one place. I'm constantly conferring with Lisa, who's sort of has the book, which is the stage management book, where we write down all the notes of the movement, and Jules, who's a choreographer, and Jill, who leads on the music. She's on the stage as an actor and as a musician, but we all work together to make the show work.
You've worked with hundreds of fully sighted actors as a director.
Yeah.
How do they respond to you as a visually impaired person?
Initially, they are sceptical. I always work with an access worker now. I didn't always used to, but I do now. And sometimes they think the access worker is a director, and I make it clear to my access workers that any questions have to come back to me. But I think after working with me for a while, people quite quickly realise I do know what I'm doing. Because my job's to help actors be the best they can be on stage. It's not about me. Take me right out of it. My job's to get the best play, to get the right emotions, to get the right pacing, so that it all feels and sounds, and to give the actors the confidence to do what they need to do, which takes a lot of guts to stand on stage and perform.
You've been an actor yourself, so you've been up there on the stage as a totally blind person.
Yeah.
What are the challenges for you being up there in front of an audience?
Well, it's interesting, because when I started, I had more sight and I could tell which direction was front, but I definitely can't now. And you saw my one-person show, which was a few years ago, 2019.
Very good, if I dare say.
Thank Thank you. But what I needed by then was a tactile floor cloth to stop me wandering and to help me direct. And I also worked in bare feet so I could fully engage with the set and the floor cloth, so I knew which way I was pointing. And I had a round table in the middle of my set, because it's all based on a compass and a ship, and had everything in those directions. But the side of the table also had some braille indicators, so I could know which way I was forward. But the tactile flooring was different at the front to the sides and to the back. So, and I worked very hard on keeping the right direction, because that's the hardest thing for me now, is getting my bearings right, because you think you're going to know, but when you've got I've virtually got no sight now, I really can't tell which way round I am sometimes. So yeah, a set helps.
You mentioned writing as well, and that's become quite a huge part of your work.
Yeah,
just tell me what you're involved with and what, if any, challenges you'd have with that.
I'm at the stage now. I haven't got an actual contract at the moment. I'm working on a stage play. I'm actually starting to think about writing a musical, because I've had funding from the Arts Council this year to develop my creative practice, and I've been really researching musicals and using my current script to look at can that become a musical, and I really think it can. So that's something I'm looking at. And that means collaborating with composers and lyricists, as well as me writing some lyrics as well as a script. So that's really exciting. The biggest challenge is the software. So for television, for television, you need to use Final Draft, and that's been a big challenge. I'm now using Final Draft. It's great. I've been involved with the team there to help sort that out. They've been great, Final Draft themselves, actually, in opening up to me and welcoming me to work with them on it. So I now use Final Draft very successfully. But that's been the hardest thing. And I think also I do work on some animation. I work quite a lot for CBeebies, and animation's really hard to get your head around when you can't see it. And I need a lot of description. And I do one of the shows, which is out at the moment, two of my episodes of Dog Squad are out at the moment for Series 3. That's a mix of animation and live action. And really get my head around how that animation works is really quite hard. But, you know, you get there. Once I visually understand it and understand how it works, it's good.
Final question for this part of the podcast, at least. What needs to change to improve the lives of disabled people in this country?
People need to stop saying no and start saying yes. People need to stop seeing us as problems and seeing us as colleagues, seeing that we have plenty to give, that we have professionalism, that we have a lot to add to the community and to society, but we need to do it on our terms, and we need to be taken seriously. And I think at the moment, whether people are aware of it or not, there is still an element where people let us get so far and then they start seeing problems, and instead of talking to us about those problems, they close us down.
People with sharp ears will be able to hear that the actors are arriving in their droves. There's so many people here.
It's a big cast.
I want to talk to you about Christmas in a minute, but we've got some music to introduce. Can you remember what we're going to play?
It's Andrea Begley with Holy Night.
Ooh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining, it is the night of our dear Saviour's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. A thrill of hope the weary world rejoices, while yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Divine.
That was O Holy Night by Andrea Begley, and I have to say, she is a fabulous singer, isn't she?
It's beautiful. It's one of those songs that gives you that chill, that sort of shiver up the spine. It's beautiful.
She won The Voice in 2013. That was amazing, wasn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, let's move on to Christmas, because I know you are...
I'll do the pantomime here.
Andrea, there's an invitation. Come and do the pantomime here. Moving
on until January.
Moving on to Christmas. I know you love Christmas.
I do.
Just tell me about the build-up to Christmas and what you'll be doing on the day itself.
Oh, gosh, right. Well, this year I've been so busy that I haven't made my cake, which I always make, a Christmas cake, and start feeding it brandy. But I haven't managed to do that this year. But I like to get my presents. I've mainly got those.
Don't spend too much on mine. Put up the tree.
Put up the decorations. That's going to be this Friday. Get all my food sorted. Get my cooking sorted. Get in the alcohol. This year, for the first time, we normally do a pantomime with my family, with my wider family, my cousins and aunts and uncles, and as well as my dear and husband and everything. You know, normally I write that, but this year what I've done for the first time is I've actually published our script from last year, and you can buy it on Amazon. Here's me plugging.
Plug.
Either through Kindle, or you can order a printed copy, and it's called Panto Party, Alice in Somerton. And it tells you how to put on a pantomime. There's a half an hour script which you can personalise, and hopefully the format, because of the Kindle format, I think you can enlarge the script. The obvious thing there is a Braille version. I'm really sorry about that, and I if anyone wants to get in touch with me, if I can organise that, I would do, but I haven't actually got an embosser or anything. But hopefully with the Kindle version it can be accessible to most people. You can always go on and improvise in your version. So yeah, it's designed for families and friends to do at a party, and the way our family does it, nobody rehearses, nobody bothers with that. Everyone spends a lot of time getting their costume together and their makeup and having a few drinks, and then we just put it on.
Is this on Christmas Day itself?
Not normally, no. Christmas Day is a bit too full on for that. It's usually Boxing Day or the day after, and it's a real fun thing to do. We never buy costumes. It's always what we've got in the house. We create a little stage area in the sitting room or the most appropriate room, put some lighting there, create seats, and when you're not in the panto, you sit and watch. So it's really, everyone can be in it.
It sounds like Christmas is a real fun time in your household.
It is. It is. And my grandmother was Austrian, so we really extend the period, because on Christmas Eve we do presents and a party, and then Christmas Day we have stockings and Christmas dinner. And yeah, we extend the period. My granddad was also Scottish, so when I was younger, we sort of certainly did the New Year's Eve thing as well.
How many people will you be cooking for?
Oh, well, actually, I'm not cooking. David's cooking.
Let me ask that again. How many people is David cooking for?
He's actually cooking for four this year. So we haven't got... I've got my cousin's son coming, but I'm losing my own youngest daughter. She's going with her boyfriend to his mum. So I've got my oldest daughter, my cousin's son, and David. So there's four of us. So we'll be playing games while David cooks and drinks whiskey. And I'm cooking Christmas Eve, so I'm doing the buffet Christmas Eve.
And once you've had Christmas dinner, what is it? Just sort of flop down in front of the telly, put some music on, something like that?
Games, telly, whatever people feel like. Yeah. It's really chilled. We don't have a plan.
It sounds like Christmas is going to be a fun time.
It is.
What about New Year?
Not so much now, because we, you know, having dogs and people let off so many fireworks, we tend to stay in with the pets, and we got a cat as well. We sometimes walk down to the front. We live in New Brighton by the sea, and sometimes we walk down to the front and watch the fireworks from Liverpool, and I obviously listen to the fireworks from Liverpool. And that's quite lovely, because in New Brighton all the ships also let off their horns, and it's quite atmospheric. It's wonderful.
Well, Mandy, thank you very much indeed for finding the time. I know you're extremely busy, so thank you very much for finding the time to speak to us. And good luck with this evening's rehearsal and with the performance itself. Are you confident it'll go well?
Great. It's on the 24th. 24th, 25th and 26th of January.
In Harrison Hall?
In Harrison Hall, yeah.
So anybody nearby, or even if you're not nearby, you could come and watch, could they?
They could. They would need to get tickets because we do tend to sell out. So get in touch with St Nick's Church to get tickets. And I don't think they're very expensive at all.
Mandy, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for speaking so openly to me and for being so entertaining. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks once again to Mandy for her time. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation and watching the rehearsals for the pantomime. Now, during our conversation, Mandy said the pantomime would be on from the 24th to the 26th of January. It's actually on from the 23rd to the 25th. That's the 23rd of January to the 25th. And as Mandy was saying, any inquiries regarding tickets, if you go to St Nick's Church. Okay, to the music. Which track have I chosen by The Vow? Well, this is one of my favourites, and it seems quite appropriate. It's Wintertime.
You.